You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman, translated by Matthew Barton, 15 lectures. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on the 5th of October, 1919. During our days here together, I have spoken of how a person can move forward from our present earthly consciousness to a cosmic consciousness, in the same way that we once moved forward from ancient Greek and Roman culture to the Middle Ages, and to the end of the medieval period, by virtue of national consciousness changing to global consciousness. We don't consider these things in abstract terms, but we try, really, to explore them so that they can become tangible aspects of our awareness. In connection with this idea of enlarging our consciousness, I told you that in the first three phases of our life, we live under the influence of forces which we can really call supersensible. From birth to our seventh year, we are connected with the forces of the earth itself, the shaping, configuring forces acting in the human organism are largely ones anchored in planet Earth itself, in its interior. Then from our 7th to 14th year, the forces of the atmosphere exert an organizing, enlivening action on us. These surge through us and penetrate us, via our breathing especially, enlivening the forms and configurations that were created in us in our first 7 years. After this, a time begins when, though it does not reach our awareness, we are exposed to the forces that work upon us from the planetary system, mediated by the Earth. In other words, the forces organizing and configuring us are not only ones we bear in our body or within its confines, but these forces issue and emanate from the Earth itself, and later from the whole solar system. Such considerations should gradually lead us to realize that we form a unity with the whole Earth. On previous occasions, I often used a comparison to characterize this awareness from a different angle. I said that a human finger is only a human finger as long as it remains connected with the human body. If we amputate it, it withers. And just as the finger relates to the whole body, as I often said, we ourselves relate to the whole Earth, and indeed to our whole solar system. We would wither and die, like the amputated finger, if sundered from the whole Earth and from our whole planetary system. In life, it is important to progress gradually from awareness of the parts to the larger whole. When we consider our human nature, we are really only partially accounted for as a physical organism and an etheric body, too. We are only a whole organism in our connection with the Earth and the larger planetary system. But if we become vividly aware of this, we realize that we belong more to the whole cosmos than merely to the Earth, since the Earth draws its forces from the cosmos. Thus we pass from a sense of dependency on the Earth to a larger sense of dependency on the cosmos. But we can deepen these things further. As you know, the sun and moon are predominant for us amongst the heavenly bodies in the planetary system surrounding the Earth. From the age of 14, thus the third phase of human life, we grow into a condition through which we become dependent upon the planetary system including Mercury, Mars, and so forth, but chiefly dependent on Sun and Moon. Our dependency on the Sun and Moon, however, can only be properly judged if we know more than outward observation tells us of their significance. Outward observation shows us the moon and its phases, full moon, new moon, first and last quarters as a crescent, as something intrinsically dark, which the sun illumines, so that it turns a brightly lit aspect toward us. Yet this is not a full picture of the nature of the moon. We can only learn to discern what exists in the cosmos if we can always regard it as a sum of forces, an interplay of forces. And we have to ask what kind of forces are actually concentrated in the moon. Human will forces are chiefly concentrated there, or better, forces that have an affinity with everything that influences us from the sub-sensible realm. From the moon shine forces that are related to the sub-sensible aspect of human nature. It is fine for a physicist to tell us that the moon is made of a kind of slag, that the sun is something like a burning, glowing fireball with a corona, emitting its fire into the universe. This gives people a sense that if they were able to make their way slowly or quickly to the sun, they would fall into a kind of glowing furnace. I have often said that this is not so, that where the sun is, there is a kind of vacuum, a void, and that light shines only from the sun's surface. In reality, where people believe there is something physical, in fact there is nothing. For the being of the sun is very much supersensible, just as the moon is subsensible. This supersensible and subsensible nature of the planetary system, concentrated in sun and moon, start to act on the human organism from around the age of 14. Firstly, they work upon the human organization insofar as moon quality is more closely related to the female element, to everything feminine in the world, while sun quality is more related to male and masculine attributes. But they also act so that we have a solar quality in everything we elaborate through thinking and cognition. While every act of will, all will impulses, have a lunar quality. Sun and moon, you see, are not only outside us in the cosmos, but also within us. And in our thinking, we are sun beings and moon beings in our will. Or, more precisely, from the age of 14, the supersensible sun forces work to develop the organs that mediate thinking in us, whereas the subsensible moon forces work to develop the organs in us that mediate will. Thus, if we take such knowledge and transform it into living reality, we can tell ourselves this: in me lives not only what exists here on earth, but also what sun and moon constitute in me. I am a citizen of the cosmos. I would not be what I am as a human being if the cosmos did not act within me. To know such things in the abstract is of no great value, but to feel inwardly that one is a being in whom sun and moon act gives us inner vitality. To feel that everything we can conceive supersensibly and will subsensibly comes from sun and moon enables us to recognize that at every step we take on the earth, something more lives in us than burgeons and springs forth on the earth itself, than experiences pleasure and pain on the earth. As well as this, sun and moon live in me at every step I take. I am not only a citizen of the earth, but a citizen of the universe. If this knowledge rises and builds like a living wave in us, a certain power comes over our thinking that it does not otherwise have. In our present time especially, people must learn to feel that the cosmos lives in them as they walk on earth. It must become strong feeling. As we gaze up at the sun, we should know, I am likewise of your being, O sun. And looking up to the moon, I am likewise of your being, O moon. Only if we carry this in us as a feeling do we become ripe to formulate social ideas. Otherwise, thinking is burdened by a degree of earthly weight. Yes, one can formulate certain abstract ideas, but not inwardly and tangibly enliven them. The social realm is something the human being as such works and acts within, whereas science comprehends only a realm from which the human being is absent. We can never understand social forces, social activity, according to a scientific model, but only with a thinking lifted upon feelings that tell us we are citizens of the cosmos. It is simply the case that this global consciousness of ours must emerge from our affinity with sun and moon. Only when we no longer feel that we are, let's say, implicated in the earth alone, but feel rather that we are only a passing dweller upon earth who introduces sun and moon forces into this earthly existence, does our thinking acquire both the strength and the lightness to enable us really to comprehend social ideas and social existence. You see, many an economist thinks that he can comprehend social concepts using the ordinary mode of thinking modeled on science. Read some books on economics. There you will find many concepts and many interpretations of them, the concept of goods and commodities, of labor, which I have mentioned in passing, and the concept of capital. But mostly, none of these are much use. They do not cover what actually lives in society. If you want to try to formulate an idea of the circulation of goods in the economy, and you conceive this as you would the idea of a crystal or a plant or an animal, or even that of the physical human organism, nothing will come of it. You cannot comprehend the concept of goods and commodities according to the scientific model. If you wish, instead, to catch up with its living reality, as this exists in society, then really, you need an imagination, since goods have a quality that is indivisible from human beings. Every commodity is endowed with something of the human, whether it is a dress or a painting. In economic terms, a painting is also a commodity. Or a school lesson. Yes, even a lesson is, in economic terms, only a commodity. The commodity concept is intrinsically connected with human output. Yet, it is not ordinary, fully conscious life that informs the commodity, but largely something arising from subconscious life. For this reason, you need an imagination in order to properly grasp the concept of goods, an inspiration to grasp the concept of labor, and an intuition to grasp the concept of capital. You see, the concept of capital is a very spiritual concept, albeit one turned on its head. That's why the Bible is quite right to call everything related to capitalism, in quotes, mammon, something connected with spirit, but not exactly the very best spirit. Nevertheless, one penetrates the highest regions of spiritual discernment in seeking to grasp what capital actually does in economic life. Here we encounter something very curious. To acquire correct economic concepts, we have to have an idea about supersensible perceptions. That is why all economic ideas emerging today are so amateurish. Since people have no supersensible perceptions and therefore fail to grasp these ideas correctly. Please do not misunderstand me. If you read my book titled Towards Social Renewal, you will say, quote, "But there is no imagination there when you speak about goods and commodities, no inspiration when you speak about labor, nor an intuition when you speak of capital." Close quote. No, that's right, there isn't. One does not need to rise into higher worlds to perceive goods, labor, and capital, although it is very interesting to do so, and to see the reflected images there of commodities, work, and capital, but there is no need to do so. Nevertheless, one must be acquainted with the nature of imagination, inspiration, and intuition if one is to speak correctly of capital. That is the important thing. Someone unfamiliar with the faculties of imagination, inspiration, and intuition will be unable to speak correctly about goods, labor, and capital. There is an intrinsic connection between spiritual science and modern sociology. And for people today, there is no other means to comprehend the life of society than by rising from earth consciousness to cosmic consciousness, and thereby acquiring the necessary lightness and strength of thinking. If we just crawl, as it were, upon the face of the earth and basically believe that we are nothing more than what we absorb and assimilate from plants, animals, and minerals, and that these just compose themselves a little differently inside us, we will never recognize the truth of our nature. Only when I say that sun and moon act within me do I recognize myself as the human being I am. Consciousness of the universe must be achieved spiritually. By spiritual means, we must recognize that we belong to a larger portion of the cosmos than the earth alone. Now, it is really important to get beyond ordinary, everyday concepts, to arrive at the kind of thinking I'm referring to. As you know, there are materialistic thinkers in the world, a very great number of them. And no doubt you are all firmly convinced that one ought not to be a materialist. Or, at least you were persuaded to a certain degree, that it would be good to cultivate a more spiritual form of thinking. At least you felt drawn to spiritual thinking, as we cultivate it here in the Anthroposophic movement. So we can leave ourselves aside here. But there are others who propound the spirit. Numerous such people in the world who dismiss the idea that everything comes down to material processes and material realities. Those who think and feel spiritually stand in contrast to materialists. The former believe in the spirit, and therefore materialists often dismiss them as fantasists. They, for their part, believe that the materialists cannot see how right they are in holding two spiritual things. So, here we have this distinction and divergence in the world between materialistic and spiritual thinking, with much dispute about who is right, materialistic or spiritual thinkers. From some of the things we have discussed, it ought to be apparent that those who continue to dispute about such things have not yet grasped the nature and meaning of spiritual science. The only true appraisal is to say to a materialist that his point of view is correct as far as it goes, as is the point of view of the spiritual thinker, likewise. You can photograph a tree from one angle and then a different one. And though each angle will present something different, it is still the same tree. A spiritual view of the world is one angle, and a material view another. Materialist thinking seems to be quite different from spiritual thinking. In fact, we have the full picture neither in a materialistic nor a spiritual outlook, which are really only photographs from two different angles. The materialist is really just as right as the spiritual thinker. And these concepts, spiritual and material, only apply on the physical plane. The moment we go beyond it, these concepts are overcome. No further dispute, then, as to whether the world is material or spiritual in nature, since then one knows that these are just two aspects. But why do people dispute as to whether the human being is material or spiritual in nature, whether a person is only corporeal or only a soul? Why do some see in human nature only physical corporeality, while others think there is soul and spirit present too? Because we are both. And here lies the secret of life. If you say that a thought is only a spiritual or mental entity, you are right, for the thought itself is only spiritual in nature. And yet, the thought as sole spiritual reality could never be in you without leaving a physical imprint. You can always demonstrate this physical imprint too. Thus every thought or idea also possesses something material. We might say that the universe has ensured in a most nonpartisan manner that people can be both spiritual and materialist in outlook. Seeing that we are sole spiritual beings, we can entertain a spiritual outlook. But we are also certainly a material impress of the soul and spirit. If we grasp this and overlook the other aspect, we can be materialists, since we are in fact constituted of both, and the one is only the impress, a reflection of the other, and both resemble each other. A person can be more of a materialist because he focuses on his physical nature, or have a more spiritual outlook because he focuses more on his soul spiritual being. We do not evade this dichotomy as long as we stay with the ideas of ordinary everyday life, or those too of ordinary science. One can invent all kinds of theories. There are no end of theories about the body-soul relationship, about their parallelism, and so forth. But such things are ingeniously worked out without any actual roots in reality. You see, people have lost the ability, I have often stressed this, to think about these things in the right way. And this is because they were historically prohibited from doing so. In 869 at Constantinople, the 8th General Council, in quotes, abolished the spirit, establishing the dogma that the human being does not consist, as was previously known in Gnostic scholarship, of body, soul, and spirit, but only of body and soul, though the soul was accorded a few spiritual properties. And therefore the medieval scholastics were extremely wary of speaking of the trichotomy of body, soul, and spirit. This was forbidden. Our professors of philosophy today are not wary in the same way, not shy of entertaining anything, and yet they have not yet overcome the Roman Catholic prohibition. They too only speak of body and soul, a duality, and believe that they are engaging in open-minded, unprejudiced, academic discourse, whereas in fact they are really only teaching the Roman Catholic dogma of the 8th General Council of Constantinople. They believe that what they say follows from impartial inquiry, but they only say it because they are governed by historical imperatives. It is our task today to return to a recognition of body, soul, and spirit. Observing the outer world and our human organization insofar as it is perceived in the same way as the outer world, we discern corporeality. If we then look inward, we can either consider our thinking, will, and feeling in an outward and superficial form of self-knowledge, or we may descend into them mystically. We experience a soul element, an outward corporeality, and soul within. But the connection between them, perception of the interplay between spirit-soul and physical body, their continual interplay, is caused by the third aspect, for which we do not even have a proper word. We have to take one aspect of the word and say spirit. And so we can say there is body and soul, and the spirit creates the connection between them. We have to return to a healthy idea of body, soul, and spirit. Otherwise, body and soul will always tend to diverge and fall asunder. In the soul, we can find nothing corporeal. In the body, nothing of the soul, unless we recognize the spirit in them at their center. Many years ago, I used a comparison to try to clarify what I mean. Here, we can imagine, is a signet with a name engraved in it, let's say a very common one such as Smith. And now I take sealing wax, perhaps on the back of a letter, and I can impress the name Smith into it. There's a drawing. Well, now along come the Kantians and physiologists, who will say that there is no connection between the signet itself, which might be made of bronze, and the sealing wax. True, the one is entirely bronze, the other entirely sealing wax. Nothing of the bronze will ever be transmitted to the sealing wax, nor vice versa. The two are definitely different in kind. The same is true of body and soul. The one imprints itself on the other, but nothing of either assumes the other's nature. Each has its own substantiality, and nothing at all, passes from the one into the other. And yet when you have pressed the signet into the sealing wax, you see the name Smith there, the same as on the signet. They are one and the same. But this correspondence did not come about because something very subtle flowed or oozed from the signet into the sealing wax. No. Something occurred that is intrinsically neither sealing wax nor bronze, but is a shared element in both. The fact that this is Smith has no connection whatever with the bronze itself, nor its constituents, but with a real living element. The fact that a person is called Smith is related to life and points to the whole breadth of life. So, here we have the soul-spirit, and here the body. The soul-spirit imprints itself in corporeality. But the element that is the same in both of them, the spirit, is a whole wide world. We do not comprehend the spirit if we only ever regard the soul, just as little as we learn to recognize Mr. Smith if we only look at the signet. Nor do we comprehend the spirit if we merely gaze at the material world, just as little as we recognize Mr. Smith by staring at the sealing wax. It is a matter, therefore, of the spirit mediating the interplay and relationship between soul and body. And in our era, we are in a phase of humanity's evolution in which it is vital to comprehend this fact properly. If you consider modern science, you will find that it offers you all kinds of corporeal reality, and really only that. Concepts of the soul and psyche from older times will give you soul quality, but we only comprehend both properly if we raise ourselves to the spirit, since we only become citizens of the cosmos, in contrast to the earth citizens we have been until now, by grasping our nature spiritually. As you will see from this, we must not only comprehend the human body as we regard all outward corporeality, but must enlarge the scope of this view to properly survey human nature. I will try to illustrate what I mean with an example. Ordinary science only considers the human being as a creature whose life ends at death. All it can observe thereafter are the bodily remains, and how these are cremated or returned to the earth, becoming dust. Now it would be possible to study the constituents in this human dust, the residue of the human organism. Science will say that human substance decomposes and rejoins the earth. Well, this is not even a fraction of the truth. It isn't true at all. You see, what is given back to the earth, irrespective of whether the body is cremated or buried, once had human form, and had this also by virtue of the fact that before birth or before conception, a being of spirit and soul descended from worlds of spirit and worked within this physical body until death. Then this physical body is given to the earth, and the nature of human form works on in the earth, irrespective of whether the body was cremated or buried, and continues to collaborate with the earth. To the earth is continually imparted something that it would not have if human beings were not given up to it at death. The earth benefits from this. Otherwise, if it did not receive human bodies, the earth would only possess earthly substances. A being of soul and spirit lived in this body, descending before birth or conception from worlds of soul and spirit, and configuring this human body. This configuration remains as something essential in every grain of dust, enters the earth or the atmosphere at cremation or burial, and with this human body, the earth receives what descended from spiritual worlds. This is not without significance. It is not even an ordinary, everyday truth, but has very great significance. You see, our earth is no longer evolving, and it would have long been the case that no human being could dwell upon it, perhaps not animals either, or perhaps animals could, if it did not continually receive rejuvenating soul spiritual forces in the form of human bodies. The earth is still habitable for humankind, because it continually receives human bodies, which keep refreshing and rejuvenating it. Since the middle of Atlantean times, the earth intrinsically has already been withering, and no longer has forces of uplift any more, which it did possess in the ancient Polaric time and in Lemurian times and so forth. Since the middle of the Atlantean period, the earth as such only has forces of withering, and is refreshed and sustained only by receiving the formative powers of human bodies which work on in the earth. Only they make the earth a place still habitable for human beings. You can see from this that on the one hand, the inner forces of the planet are active within us, and the forces of the atmosphere. But we also give back soul spiritual forces to the earth. We supply the earth with soul spiritual forces. When we are born, we bear soul spiritual forces from the spiritual universe into the earthly realm, and use them as long as we need them, until death. Then we give them to the earth as formative powers, and so become collaborators, helping to shape the future earth. If asked what the human being signifies for the earth, proponents of the external scientific outlook would say, roughly, quote, if the human being had never arisen on the earth, everything would still have evolved as it did. The only difference would be the absence of man. Houses would not be there either, of course, nor cities and so on. In other words, whatever human culture has produced. But otherwise, everything else would be the same, close quote. But spiritual science teaches us that the human being is not just an observer here on the earth, but through his very existence, a collaborator, a co-shaper of it, and that he does this also through the body he gives up to the earth at death, becoming a mediator between the world of spirit and this physical world of earth. Intrinsic to this also is the awareness of being more than a citizen of the earth, of being a citizen of the cosmos. The earth citizen is born to mother and father, bears inherited characteristics, acquires various qualities that he passes on as inherited traits, and so on. Someone who knows himself to be a citizen of the cosmos realizes that by entering this existence at birth, he bears into this world a soul spiritual element, and that at death, when he departs this earth, he also continues to contribute to the edifice of future earth existence. Only as a citizen of the cosmos does a person recognize fully how his existence is connected with earthly existence, how he is one being with it. And by being so basically endows the earth with its spirituality. All these ideas that we can acquire from spiritual science should not be acquired or assimilated in the same way as ordinary knowledge. Although it may be a little paradoxical to say this, knowledge is not especially valuable. What is valuable is what we become through knowledge. This also applies to education. To teach a child geography does have a certain outward significance, but not initially great inner value. Outwardly, its significance lies in knowing later that when you're traveling from Dornach to Zurich, you don't mistake Bern for Zurich or such like. But its inner value lies in what the soul becomes through learning geography. The soul acquires a capacity to orient itself in the world. Certain spiritual forces are released from the depths, from the roots of the soul. And the release of these spiritual forces is the important thing. Now, if we consider the period that began in the middle of the 15th century, it is a time when people were least inclined to release these soul spiritual forces within them. They adhered more to the impress, to the sealing wax. Since the middle of the 15th century, people have entered the age of materialism. But now we are at a point when we must become aware of this and must return to the spirit, connecting the spirit with matter. Why did all this occur? To superficial appraisal, it might seem that the Lord God could have made things easier for himself. He could simply, without more ado, have given humankind a life of spirit in the 15th century, avoiding the whole arduous detour we have made through materialism. Perhaps he could have done so. The Protestants get offended if you suggest he couldn't have. But that is of little interest now. The truth is, he didn't avoid this detour, but allowed human beings to delve their way deeply through materialism, to wrestle their way through it. In the 19th century, they reached the nadir of materialism. If they were now to wend their way back to spirituality, they would need a strong inner impulse. This strong inner impulse is released by freedom, is released by the fact that a person turns to spirituality out of himself, and not through divine inoculation, as it were. If we had not delved deeply into materialism, we could not wrestle our way through to spirituality out of our own freedom. This arduous penetration of material reality invoked in humankind the urge to autonomy. This wrestling with and penetration of matter was so strong that even the religions and theology became material in nature. A modern theologian even finds it hard today to comprehend something spiritual, perhaps even harder than anyone else. Recently, I was discussing something with a Catholic theologian, and as fate would have it, we were standing beneath the well-known picture by Raphael, the Disputa. In the course of our conversation, I tried to illustrate something by relating it to this painting. I said that anyone who seeks to cultivate the life of spirit must come to the point of recognizing why Raphael, in the consciousness of his time, painted the Disputa. Above we see the heavenly worlds with the Trinity, below the sacrament on the altar, and the church fathers and theologians. But on their own, none of these things are the most essential aspect of the painting. What is essential is this, that a theologian with deeper insight, and many no longer had this at the time, who took his theology seriously, as Raphael did, so that its soul imbued his painting, would know that when the host, the sacrament, has been consecrated, and one gazed through it, one gazed upon the world that Raphael painted in the upper portion of the Disputa. The consecrated host really is the means to gaze through into the world of spirit, and that is why Raphael painted it in this way. That was by way of example. And what I mean is that we must find the path back to comprehending the true content of such a painting, which was painted out of a consciousness different from our own. I am unable at this minute to conjure before you the grimace this theologian made when urged to see his holiest sacrament in this spiritual manner. Theology itself has been materialized, perhaps more than anything else. It no longer connects with a truly spiritual element, and that is why Christology itself has become materialistic. For the theologian of the 15th century, it would have been impossible as yet to regard Christ merely as the, quote, simple man of Nazareth, close quote. At that time, he still had a vivid sense of the Christ indwelling Jesus of Nazareth, an awareness that has since faded. For theologians today, the simple man of Nazareth, as they define him, is just a figure, like Socrates, Plato, or Aristotle, albeit a little more elevated. Theology itself has become materialistic. Out of the inmost comprehension of our humanity, we need to accomplish the volte face of turning to spirituality in freedom. We cannot do this by churning out spiritual phrases, just talking of spirit. We can only do so by thinking spiritually. And it is to think spiritually if we say that knowledge is connected with the forces of the sun and will with the forces of the moon. As human bodies are created here on earth through the stream of heredity, a solar quality, not an earthly one, acts in the male energy, while a lunar quality acts in the female energy. The earth sows and strews itself with solar-lunar power, also in human reproduction. And this human reproduction is in turn related to forces of cognition and will. The spiritual penetrates the physical. The physical creates a spiritual reflection. The synthesis and interplay of soul and body is what we must still seek today as something absolutely essential. This cannot be done by resorting to the shadowy concepts that have developed in modern times since the mid-15th century. They only go back that far. Instead of these inwardly devised concepts, we need an inwardly experienced life of spirit. But only the life of spirit, truly experienced, leads at the same time to practical actions. Our cultural and spiritual life has been impractical for long enough. For long periods now, people have been discussing how to be good, how to be brotherly, how to practice love for one's neighbor, and so on. But the ideas devised in this way remained in their confined sphere and did not have the power to impact on practical life. If you think of a modern businessman, a really modern industrialist, or let's say a civil servant, so that we have all three types, it is possible, of course, for him also to be a pious man. But there is a considerable difference between the businessman's inner faith or confession and the work of his that comes to expression in his accounts. What lives in his religious life has no power to enter the account books. And the civil servant is not educated to be a human being so much as a servant of the state. How is what he learned in order to be a clerk or civil servant related to the inner faith he may have? Religious life is one stream, while so-called practical life is another, divorced from it. Since concepts and ideas have lost their potency and cannot impact on practical life, we can no longer develop ideas vigorous enough to really affect the life of society. They need to be reinvigorated by spiritual science, so that they grow strong enough again to be more than church sermons, which may elicit warm feelings in the heart, giving pleasure within, but do not find their way into the work that comes to expression in business accounts. Ideas and concepts need to push on further into practical life, and can do so if they are drawn from the Spirit. You see, ideas are not spiritual if they do not, by virtue of their inner vigor, delve down into the deepest essence of matter. You can discern the spirituality of an idea by the fact that it penetrates into the deepest stratum of material life. And this is what we need if we are to bridge the gulf that yawns still between modern humanity today, with all the legacies it possesses from an earlier era, and future humanity, which absolutely must create a synthesis and interplay between the material and the spiritual. To be either materialist or spiritual in outlook is simply to fall back into older modes of human feeling. Only if you can be both, so that both livingly interpenetrate, can you become equal to the contemporary needs of human society. The end of Lecture 3.